Hi Jason, how's it going this morning for you?
Well, good, thanks, Cormac. Yeah, I just come off. I'm a co-host with a on a school of philosophy class, so it's a brilliant school of practical philosophy, which is all about the kind of things that we're talking about, I suppose, today. We were just talking about beauty this morning. What
Wow.
is beauty, and how do you define beauty, and is beauty common for everyone, or is it, obviously everyone says beauty is in the eye of the beholder, which is, I suppose that is the key part of beauty. But I was also saying about the fact that when we want to photograph something, it's probably because we think it's beautiful, that it's the beauty we want to capture. And often we sort of end up fumbling around trying to find the camera, and we actually miss the moment, the beautiful moment, so it's and also sound recording. I said that the only way of capturing beauty is just through sound.
I've just read something very interesting actually by in the book Wild by Jane Griffiths, and she writes about that the philosophy of beauty was all written about by men, and that it's a concept tied up with men's desire for women to be delicate and pretty and beautiful, and that if you actually want to move beyond that patriarchal consideration of beauty, you need to start considering the sublime, the things that are, and this isn't about photography, obviously, but the things that are like, not trying to create an image of female that protects men's ego, but this idea of the sublime being exactly that feeling of exactly what it is, not what you want it to be.
Yes. Yeah, it's a fascinating subject to discuss. And, again, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, discussion of the as a subject of beauty is also.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Hi, I'm Cormac.
And I'm Josh.
Welcome to the Living Project.
Be true, live wild.
Hi, I'm Jason. Welcome to my Living Project podcast.
Our conversation today is with Jason Le Mazurier, who takes the time to chat to us from his home in Donegal on the wild west coast of Ireland. It's a miracle that we're having this conversation at all. In 2007, Jason had a kite surfing accident, which resulted in a severe brain injury that has a 95% mortality rate. His story of recovery is truly inspirational. In an instant, his life and that of his family changed forever. He says, metaphorically speaking, that he went from surfing the top of the wave of life to crashing down onto the sea floor.
The wild, particularly water, have been his passion and teacher throughout his journey. He's a self-described adrenaline adventure seeker. Before his accident, Jason's professional life was flying. As an engineer and academic, he worked in New Zealand where he taught construction management at Canterbury University. There, he focused on post-disaster reconstruction, which was particularly relevant following the Christchurch earthquake. As it turns out, his logical mind, life-saving surgery, and the rock of his family, his wife Liz and his children, were the critical factors as he first responded and they began their long road to recovery. Jason went from a coma to walking down the aisle to marry Liz, and 5 years after leaving hospital, he went back and asked the neurologist, who told him he'd never walk again, to sponsor him in a triathlon. He's since gone on to run the Dublin Marathon too. Today, Jason seeks to use his crisis in a positive way, as a catalyst to come back stronger and give hope to individuals and organizations facing seemingly impossible challenges. There's wisdom in this story and relevance to us all in our current predicament.
Okay, let's dive in. So, Jason, it's lovely to have the opportunity to talk to you today. I'm wondering, how's the wild west coast of Ireland?
Oh well, it's quite beautiful today. I mean, there's a bit cloudy, a few clouds, but there's a lot of blue sky as well. And there has been a bit of snow yesterday, but it's just disappeared. But there's a very oh, there's a few little grains on the ground still, actually, where it froze overnight. But very cold like everywhere else, I think, in this part of Europe.
Yeah, I'm currently sat on my boat and the canal is frozen over.
Yeah.
So the west of Ireland, Donegal, beautiful place. But yes. I detect a distinctly English accent, Jason.
Yeah.
And not that. An Irish surname either. So how did you end up living on the Emerald Isle?
Well, my wife is from here. We're living next, you know, very near to her parents. Ballinhead is very close to here, which is, you know, the place that a lot of people would have heard of in terms of on the shipping forecast. So Ballinhead is one of the coastal stations that they mention. But it's right at the top northwest of Ireland. So not only we're the top northwest of Ireland, we're actually the northwest corner of Europe, if you think about it. You know, this is the furthest, actually where I live is pretty much as far as the edge of Europe as you can imagine, you know.
Yeah.
Next stop is Iceland.
Yeah, I mean, and you're still in Europe, which is lovely.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Not a political broadcast, but just wanted to throw it out there.
yeah.
Okay.
Yes, but as you say, my name and my accent are English. I grew up in North Devon, which is quite like here, really. It's a sort of rugged Atlantic coast, and that's why I love the coast, I suppose. But my name is obviously not that particularly English. It's from Jersey, so it's still British, but very close to France. So it's that's why the French influence. Yeah.
What a brilliant cultural hodgepodge.
Yes, the three beautiful places, you know, Jersey, North Devon and northwest of Ireland. You know, I always pick the best places.
Absolutely. And certainly in my experience, I've always found Donegal, when I've been there, to be a beautiful, wild place. You know, those big, wild beaches, rugged headlands. Really kind of an inspiring place to be. And as you know, you're on this, we're fortunate to be joined by you today to kind of weave those wild stories into our lives and our journeys. And that comes from, you know, our belief that we humans benefit in a number of ways from a conscious engagement with the wild. We'd really love to know a little more detail about your relationship with the wild, what the wild means to you.
Yeah. The wild means to me being away from civilization in a way. I mean, obviously, wherever you go these days, there's always some glimpse of human civilization. Might be a house on a distant hill or a pylon, you know, might be in the middle of nowhere, but you know, you find or a windmill. I mean, that's the thing these days that's cropping up all over the place in the most beautiful wild places, and windmills everywhere. So it's very hard to find somewhere, I suppose, around here in UK and Ireland where you can feel completely cut off from civilization. You know, that there's always a sign of something in your vision that my definition of the wild would be somewhere where you can see no signs whatsoever of human existence in a way, you know.
Yeah. What has been your relationship with the wild? What are some standout things or experiences in the wild that have been part of your journey of life so far?
Well, for me, it's always got to be the ocean, the sea. That's my passion. That's where I get my solace, you know. That and also, going back to what I said before, it's the place where you can really get to somewhere where there's no evidence of humans existing. You know, in the middle of the ocean, you can see nothing except the wide blue ocean and the wide blue sky, and you know, it's just completely away from anything else. So that's my destiny for the wild. Is no evidence of other humans,
except plastic bottles.
Yeah, I suppose. Yes.
But it's all relative, isn't it? You know, if you live in the middle of the urban jungle in London, the wild might be Hampstead Heath, mightn't it? And you're living in this place that I just imagine is just naturally wild, Donegal. You know. But yet, for you, in your definition, Donegal's not even particularly wild, because there's this evidence of human civilization all around. So with that in mind, you know, are even within that, are there moments where you feel connected with the wild, either now in Donegal or maybe some things that you've done in the past that you've really felt that was a wild experience?
Yes, well, I suppose, again, it would go back to sailing. And although you'd be with other people generally on the sort of boats in the places that I'm talking about, but I've actually done the Round Island race twice on a 50-foot yacht, racing yacht. And one of the wildest places I can remember from that was Bantry Bay, maybe about 20 or 30 miles offshore into the Atlantic, down near Bantry Bay. And the swell was so big there, the Atlantic swell was so big that at the top of the swell, the wind was quite strong, maybe four, possibly five. But at the bottom of the trough of the wade, the swell was so high that it actually blanketed you from the wind. So when it went down into the bottom of the swell, it would be quite calm because there was no wind reaching it down there. So that to me was a really wild experience, I suppose.
Yeah, been in some big seas off places like Beachy Head on the south coast, and just ploughing into those deep troughs and like, whoa, everything disappears, and then bang, as you rise up again, bang, the wind comes on and over she goes, and you're like, whoa!
Yes.
Okay, so I think that we've established that you have a connection with water, and we know that, you know, the places that, you know, you've told us, you know, kind of Jersey and Ireland, that sailing and the water has been a big part of your life. You've told us in your bio, and you've just kind of had given us a little story about sailing. But we also know that water is about the obstacles and the challenges we face in life, so metaphorically. And we know that you have two things, a special relationship with water, and also that your engagement with water when you were kite surfing
nearly killed me, basically.
Yeah, so an accident kite surfing around the place that you love, water, nearly killed you in 2007, and was a hugely life-changing moment and a crisis for you and your family. So I think we'd probably like to go there, if that's okay. Can you take us back to that moment and what happened, and how did it change your life?
Well, I'll come on to how it changed my life in a minute, but the story was, or you know, what actually happened was that I was very much a novice kite surfer. I'd not really managed to get up properly on the board at that stage. I mean, I was still learning, and it was in the very early days of kite surfing. I think kite surfing started in the early 2000s, basically, and it just came about from people, I suppose, just having a surfboard and getting a big kite and getting pulled along. And the gear kind of developed, but at that stage the gear was very, very dangerous because it hadn't been made safe. But you know, there were some safety systems. There was some kind of release mechanism up here when I had the kite on. But I got set up on my own, which I'd not done before. Actually, I had someone with me who would help me set up. But the key thing there would be that he'd hold on to the back of my harness, and you know, if I started getting pulled along, he could just stop me. But so anyway, on this day, he was already out surfing and there was a few other people out, so I thought, oh well, if they think it's okay, it must be all right. Although it's quite strong, it was about six to seven possibly, which is pretty strong. And
this was in January, right? So it's cold too.
Yes, yeah, I had a, you know, good winter steamer wetsuit on, so it was all right. Got that on and I was warm enough. But so I got the kite set up, and you put sand on it normally to just keep it held down until you're ready to go. Then I would have hooked it onto my harness, a big sort of hook that's got a slight kink in it to stop it coming off.
And then as I pulled the rope, pulled the strings to lift the kite off, it shot right up. I mean, I don't remember too much about this. I can imagine how it would have been and how it would have felt. But so once the kite had filled with air and was pulling hard, then it would have pulled me. I was probably started running along the beach, realised it was too strong, wind, and tried to take it off the harness, but there was no way I could shift it. There was so much weight on it at that stage. So probably running along the beach, trying to hold it or stop myself. And then I don't really remember much after that. Somehow the wind lifted me about 20 feet in the air and dropped me on my head on the hard sand on Blackpool Beach. And, I was lucky to survive that impact at all. That should have just killed me instantly, but somehow I didn't. And my friend called the air ambulance, and I mean, another amazing coincidence or fortunate thing is that the air ambulance is based at Blackpool Airport, which is like literally half a mile from where I was lying bleeding on the beach. And they picked me up and took me to Preston Royal Hospital, and I was in hospital probably on the operating table in less than an hour after my accident. So there is, people talk about the golden hour when it comes to brain injury or, accidents like that. There's a golden hour where, to get the treatment you need, it's got to be very, very quick. I mean, just in comparison, I think possibly when Michael Schumacher, which was around the same time as me, had his injury, he probably didn't get the help as quickly as I did. And so that's, that had consequences for him, which fortunately it didn't have for me. And so when I arrived in hospital, when they got a brain injury arriving in hospital, they always score people on it's called the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is, I suppose a number of tests or assessments to see what your body's actually doing. But in my case, it was doing absolutely nothing, and I scored 3 out of 15 on the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is, as low as you can possibly go. And I've done research, obviously, to find out what was actually going on. And it says that at that point, at that level, the surgeon has to make up their mind whether to go full out, and they call it aggressive treatment, which basically means, massive amount of surgery and very intense. And the surgeon makes that decision, is it worth doing that? Or is he just a goner and will start looking at, organ donation or something? I don't know what goes through their mind, but he decided he would operate aggressively on me and cut a big lump of my skull out and relieved the blood, the hematoma, basically got me somehow stable. And and then I was not going to die, basically. And that was when the journey for recovery and rehabilitation started.
Yeah, so Jason, obviously that moment, in a second, everything is potentially turned on its head, changed, and I know that up until that point, you clearly had a love of adrenaline sports. You've already talked about being on ocean going yachts and wanting to, and being sort of a pioneer in terms of kite surfing. But I also know that you were an engineer, and that you had studied to be an academic. You had a PhD in engineering, and you'd also taken the opportunity to head out and work and live in New Zealand. So you had this whole life that you had at the time, and I'm sure you probably had some images or ideas of how that might unfold for you and your family at that time. But in that moment, suddenly what you hoped for life had totally, totally changed. So I'm just wondering, as you started to get to grips with what had happened to you and started to maybe make some small recovery. What did you start? How did you start processing that change? And what do you think it started to kind of mean for you?
Well, as you say, my life. I mean, I think surfing would be a good metaphor for this in terms of my whole career and my personal life. We're on the crest of a wave. I was kind of surfing along as fast as you possibly could, and everything was wonderful. You know, you imagine that, being on the top of a wave and the wind whistling past your head, and, you know, incredible feeling of... Anyway, that's how my life was, in that sense, in terms of my career was on a very steep upward trajectory. I was touring the world, speaking at conferences. I was setting up various research projects in New Zealand. I was involved with some sort of industry or collaboration through my research. And everything was going fantastic. But the main incredible, fantastic thing was that 60 days before my accident, I met Liz in Sydney. It was incredible how we met, because we both happened to be walking the Botanic Gardens in Sydney at the same time. Liz was smiling at the rain because she imagined being home in Donegal. She got fed up with all the heat and was quite happy to see the rain. And when I walked past her, I saw her smile. I thought she was smiling at me. We both carried on walking. And then I found her a bit shortly after that. She was looking a bit lost, standing in a tree looking lost. So I said, "Are you okay?" I said, "I've got a map. Can I show you down to the Opera House?" And that was where it all started, really. And that was, you know, our journey over the next 350 days was just incredible. You know, I don't want to use a cliche, but we were head over heels in love. And so her next stop was going to be Christchurch, where I was living. So when she arrived in Christchurch, even though her friend had said, "Be careful of the man you met in the park, he might be a serial killer." She was pretty nervous when I insisted on picking her up at the airport in Christchurch. But even though she was nervous, I managed to persuade her to come back to a beautiful house I was looking after some friends at the time. And that's where it all started, really. And we had, as I say, an incredible year. Still travelling the world with my research a bit, and touring around New Zealand, and, you know, and then having go back to England, Liz met my three older children, Kate, Louie and Jenny, who'd gone back, their mum had taken them back after we split up, taken them back to the UK from New Zealand. But by the end of 2006, Liz was actually pregnant. You know, we'd cemented our, you know, we decided long before we were going to spend the rest of our lives together. So she was, you know, we were both overjoyed with the fact that we were going to have a baby, and Kate, Louie and Jenny will have a little brother or sister. And so, as I say, my life was on this crest of a wave. Everything was going fantastic. But then the wave broke, came crashing down, and had my accident. And I've been swimming ever since to try and get back on, well, at least get my head above water, but still like to get back onto the crest of the wave if I could.
So you feel like you've been swimming ever since. Now, you, to put some context in this, the level of brain injury that you experienced in this kite surfing accident has a mortality rate of around 95%.
Exactly.
So it's clearly a massively significant brain injury, and has clearly been a lot, you know, you're talking about, you feel like you're still swimming, and the injury occurred in January 2007. So we're talking 14 years ago now. What has swimming involved over the last 14 years in terms of that recovery?
Right. Well, I suppose the main thing at the start was the fact that I was completely paralysed down my left-hand side. When I first woke up, I mean, I'll just say something about the
the day I woke up.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 25th of January, which was exactly the day, the first day of the anniversary that Liz and I had met. And they took me off the medication that was keeping me in a coma that day. And Liz was told, if he doesn't wake up today, he'll never wake up. This was the day of the first anniversary of our meeting. So, you know, you can imagine what she went through. It was just unimaginable, really. Then I was on a roller coaster in hospital. Jack was born 6 months after my accident. So, you know, for Liz, it was just an absolute nightmare, I suppose. I was on the verge of death several times that year. And on top of that, she had Jack to look after. So I don't know how she managed it. She just somehow soldiered on and got through it, and a whole series of... Anyway, nearly 2 years in hospital, in October 2008, as I was about to leave, my consultant said to me, the physio had done their best, and I couldn't even sit up straight on a bed at that stage. And he said, sorry, Jason, but we don't think you're ever going to walk again. You're not going to walk again. So so I just said to Liz, look, I'm going to walk again. I don't care what they say. I'm definitely going to walk again. And I knew with her strength and devotion to me, she would be, you know, she'd be there all the way. And she was my rock. She's always been my rock throughout this whole thing. And she's just incredible. There's no way I'd be here today if it wasn't for Liz. And so anyway, with that prediction, after I got out of hospital, Liz was pushing me and Jack in a wheelchair. Jack would sit on my lap and she pushed us both around together. And I was standing up within about a week. Well, two, certainly I was standing. And then the other thing was that Jack, at that stage, he was 18 months old, and he was crawling, but he was just beginning to try and stand up, and he was getting, it was about the same as me. So so then the race was on. I set my goal to learn to walk before Jack. So I must be the first person ever to learn to walk with their son. And then we did learn to walk together. I don't know who got there first, but we were both having races to be the first to reach Liz's arms when she was carrying us both on to walk. So once I'd done that, then our wedding had been delayed because of my accident. We'd have been married about a year before if it hadn't been for my accident. But so I was still quite unsteady. I was still using the wheelchair and still not really able to walk properly. And so I said to Liz, look, I'm going to walk down the aisle on our wedding day. There was no way I was going to get pushed in a wheelchair. So with Liz's devotion and dedication to our rehab, she brought me to the physios and she got me ready. And, you know, about a month before our wedding, we finally got rid of the wheelchair. And then on the day of the wedding, I not only walked down the aisle, I actually broke into a jog. So Liz's friend was waiting at the other end of the aisle. So as I jogged away from Liz, her friend held me up at the end. So another first, I think, for the groom to run away from the bride into the arms of another woman. So two big firsts. Yeah. But everyone clapped and cheered, you know. So we then, you know, continued on, and I was still quite paralysed, particularly. My legs were still quite weak, so I gradually progressed onto a treadmill, and I was able to then increase my speed and stamina until I was running, not just jogging, I was actually starting to run. So got my legs back fine. But my left arm was still quite badly paralysed because that had been paralysed ever since the start. So I couldn't use it. I used to go around with it in a wheelchair with it sitting on a pillow on my lap. And so needed some more physio on my arm, and got it back. When I first came out of hospital, I was playing with Jack's toys with him, you know, to get my hand and arm working. So we gradually progressed from Jack's toys onto being able to lift him up, because that was the other big thing I really missed. I really wanted to do was be able to hold Jack and lift him up. So I did. I managed to lift Jack, and then I got my arm back, and I thought, right, well, my next goal is going to be swimming, riding a bike. So swimming was pretty good because it was supported by the water, and riding a bike was interesting because I couldn't find my balance, and somehow, you know, as they say, you never forget to ride a bike. So somewhere in the depths of my brain, I knew I had to do it, but I couldn't get to it. You know, it was somewhere hidden deep. But went out with the physio several times with her holding me up because I couldn't balance. And then fifth time out, actually, I found it. I found the balance, and I was away. I was cycling, and you know, pretty well. I was able to cycle properly as I'd done before, and so now I've got swimming, running, and riding a bike. I thought, well, what should I set as my next goal then? I've got all those three. I thought, well, the obvious thing is a triathlon, isn't it?
You'll never walk again. Oh, all I heard was triathlon.
Well, that's the really interesting or satisfying part of the story was that having entered the Skipton Triathlon to raise money for the air ambulance that saved my life, I went back to my consultant in the hospital and said, you know, they'll be told me I'd never walk again. Well, will you sponsor me to do a triathlon now?
What was the consultant's reaction?
Well, I think after he picked his jaw off the floor, you know, sort of incredible, you know, he couldn't believe it. And then he did actually sponsor me. I suppose he couldn't not sponsor me. But I know all the staff in the hospital were just amazed and delighted to see me at this stage. So that was a great feeling, actually, to go in and ask him to sponsor me. So Liz and I did it. Liz and I answered together. We've been a team partnership throughout this. So she entered it with me, and we completed it. Not in any great time, but we did it together. And, you know, we were on a, you know, big milestone in our journey together, I suppose. And then since then, I've gone to run the Dublin Marathon twice. So it's almost like I'm on this mission now to prove the consultant as far wrong as I can. You know, it's like triathlon, marathon, now maybe Everest or something. You've walked to the South Pole. I don't know yet.
So, Jason, you're giving us a real insight into what you value in life and who you are. You know, clearly, your family, and Liz in particular, has been absolutely crucial in your recovery, and more so in your intrinsic belief and doggedness and determination to be able to walk again, to go on to run marathons. But I wonder, those are some of the key things you've mentioned. I wonder, there's two sides to this question. One is, what values did you have that you think were driving you at that time? And have those values changed now, post-accident? Or do you think it's those values, things like determination, etc., that have driven you forward to this point in your life now?
My main value is my family. They're what I value above anything else in my life. But I think one of the problems that I've come out with is actually just being quite selfish, you know, because it's all been about me for the last 14 years. Everyone's been saying about, you know, I've been the centre of attention, and I've kind of got to the point where I've been becoming quite selfish in a way. So I hate that about myself. And I'd say Liz is the glue, the love glue that's held us all together. And I value her more than anything. And what she's been through is just can't be imagined. From the first day, the first night she got that phone call to say,
you better come and be by his bed, because we don't know if he's going to survive the night. I just can't believe how devastating that was to her. But that was just the start of her journey. And she had to go through the next 6 months of her pregnancy without a partner by her side. And then on the day of Jack's birth, I was wheeled into the delivery suite and I could hardly hold my head up to see him being born. After that point, Liz was basically a single parent, having to not only look after a new baby, but to endure the roller coaster of my recovery. And she sat by my bedside the whole way through with Jack, watching me take one step forward and two steps back as I had a plate put in to replace the skull that they'd cut out. And that got infected and had to be removed and replaced again. One day, Liz was sat by my bed and watched the pressure in my head rising and rising and rising when none of the other medical staff had seen it. So she, when it got so high, she eventually screamed at the staff and said, "Look, you've got to do something about this." And at that point, they rushed me off and had drilled boreholes into my head to relieve the pressure. So Lynch, on that occasion, she literally saved my life. Then once I was out of the main medical challenges, I was then in rehab. And Liz has said how tragic it was to see me being hoisted out of the wheelchair and basically poured onto the floor to play with Jack, our new baby. Then once I was over that initial stages of rehab and I was ready to leave, Liz found a house for us to stay in. And it was especially adapted. Fortunately, she found somewhere that had a wet room and a stair lift, and which made her job easier in a way that she basically had two babies to look after. One 6 month old baby and one 40-year-old baby. And she was changing both of our nappies. It's just her stamina and her endurance to go through that is just incredible. She did have some carers to help her, but most of the time she was on her own looking after two babies, one little one and one very big one. She pushed us both together in a wheelchair until we learned to walk.
Wow. It sounds like that value of love glue and appreciating the love glue that Liz and your family has provided in this, on this journey, is pretty strong, and what keeps you going. And thank you for sharing that.
Your near fatal accident and that recovery tells us that you've got a strong fire within, you know, a real desire to live life as fully as you possibly can. And whilst we've been talking at length about this huge moment in your life, and I do know that it certainly doesn't define you. And I'm wondering, you know, right now, and that fire that you've clearly got, what's igniting your fire now? You know, what are your new dreams, and what are you seeking to create for yourself, but also for your family moving forward now, Jason?
Well, I think my new dreams, as all along since my accident, have been to compensate my family for the devastation, trauma that I've put them all through in this terrible episode in all of our lives. My main aim now, my main dream now, is to get back to the father, husband, son and brother that I was before my accident. It's the only way I can compensate my family for everything I've put them through.
We can only wish you success and support in that dream. Jason, thanks for sharing that.
One of my big motivations now is to give other people the benefit of my experience, as in if I could have heard my story at the time, when he told me I'd never walk again, if I could have heard my story then, I would have thought, well, he did it. Why can't I, you know, inspire people to tell, to say, well, however bad things might seem, if you can find the determination and don't take no for an answer, don't, you know, don't give up, then that would be my, that would what, that's what really drives me on now, is to say, well, I've had this experience, I've got to take some good out of it. I don't want to be a victim. I don't want to, you know, say it's destroyed my life and I'll, you know, just curl up and do nothing. Whereas now my drive is to use it in a positive way to give hope and help to other people. So,
And that, I suppose, is kind of, you know, a bit of fire and air, isn't it? You talked there about this kind of what your motivations are. What are you, what are you doing to inspire and work with others based on your experience?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that I'm doing as a, you know, taking my initiative to reach out to people is that we've set up a new charity. You could call it a charity. It's an initiative to give people hope, and we're calling it HABIT, which stands for Hope After Brain Injury Trauma. And it's an interesting acronym, HABIT, because after a brain injury, one of the ways of getting back on your feet and getting experience of a, you know, to a new life is to form new habits. So you know, it's a way of giving hope to people by telling our story, but also encourage people to create new habits to help them adapt to their new life. And we initially thought about doing this on our own. HABIT would be a sort of standalone initiative, but we found out there's a few other people doing the same thing. You know, brain injury survivors who'd set up something to do something similar. So we decided to work with another charity called Touchpoint. So we're going to be doing some blogs and, you know, just generally tell our story. Because as the name says, Hope After Brain Injury Trauma, we want to use our experience, what we've been through, to give other people hope.
And you've got a pretty wise, powerful quote on your business card, don't you, that kind of sums up kind of what you want to offer people. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, well, my sort of strap line on the business card is written as crisis equals catastrophe or catalyst, ? So the answer to the question is, in my case, I could have said, well, the doctor said I'll never walk again, so he must be right, he's got the experience, so I'll just get used to being in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. So I could have answered that question as catastrophe. But in my case, crisis, my answer to that question was, my crisis is my catalyst. So it's been my, you know, in a way, this crisis has been my motivation to get fitter than I ever was. I wouldn't have run a marathon before my accident, but certainly been spurred on with my view of seeing it as a catalyst.
I think that's a really, we often ask people at the end, Jason, for a piece of wisdom to share with the world. And I feel like that potentially is yours. Crisis equals catastrophe or catalyst, ? And yeah. If any listeners are inspired by this introduction to Jason's story, the journey he's been on, and his, you know, his passionate desire to share his story to create hope and demonstrate the capacity of human resilience and human recovery, we're going to put all of Jason's contact details in the episode notes. So please do get in touch with Jason to get him involved with inspiring and providing hope to your people.
Yeah. So Jason, thank you so much for being with us today and talking to myself and Josh and sharing your very human story. Personally, I've been very inspired. I'm training at the moment to do a long ultra run, and just yesterday I only ran 27 kilometers, and I was complaining a bit about aching bones and muscles. I think after talking to you, I've definitely going to put that into perspective and to turn it on its head. And rather than focusing on the sore, aching bones and muscles, to be very more, much more mindful to just celebrate the fact that I'm out in the wild, experiencing my mind and my body, and being grateful that I can do that. So thanks very much.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I think on that point that most people take walking for granted. You know, everyone thinks, well, I can walk, but I now see it as a privilege. You know, if you're told you'll never do something, it's taken away from you. But if you can, then it's a privilege to be able to do it again. And as you say, I want to be able to give that message to other people that, you know, there's always some light at the end of the tunnel, and the light might be even brighter than it was before. As you said before, if anyone's interested to find out more about what I can offer, and I really do want to take something positive out of what's happened to me and give other people the benefit.
Sounds great. You've heard it. Jason is keen to be of service and to use his experience to benefit others, so please get in touch. Jason has clearly had a powerful relationship with the wild. From seeking adrenaline and adventurous activity and a love of the ocean, it was his relationship with the wild that caused him the greatest trauma and challenge in life. In fact, his relationship with the wild nearly killed him. However, his relationship with the wild has also been part of his recovery. It's been a really powerful story today.
And I think we can also celebrate the power of relationships, of family. And in Jason's case, what he's told us is his rock, his family, his wife Liz, have been really the key reasons that have given him the determination to put all his effort into overcoming this trauma and creating a new life that gives hope, not just to him and his family, but to others.
We hope you've enjoyed it today. We look forward to seeing you next time.
In the meantime,
be true, live wild.
You've been listening to The Living Project with Josh Bulpin and Cormac Davey.
Enjoyed it? Please subscribe, follow, rate, and share with everyone you know. See you next time.
Be true, live wild.